He's always liked kids.
I didn't know, I said. I really had been out of it lately. That's just great, Hoyt. Holly's a real nice girl. I wasn't sure if I would have put it quite that way if I'd had time to think, so maybe it was lucky I didn't. There were some big positives about Holly, devoted to her son Cody, loyal to her friends, a competent worker. She'd been divorced for several years, so Hoyt wasn't a rebound. I wondered if Holly had told Hoyt she was a Wiccan. Nope, she hadn't, or Maxine wouldn't be smiling so broadly.
"We're meeting her for lunch at the Sizzler," she said, referring to the steakhouse up by the interstate. "Holly's not much of a churchgoer, but we're working on getting her to come with us and bring Cody. We better get moving if we're going to be on time."
"Way to go, Hoyt," I said, patting his arm as he went by me. He gave me a pleased look. Everyone was getting married or falling in love. I was happy for them. Happy, happy, happy. I pasted a smile on my face and went to Piggly Wiggly. I fished Amelia's list out of my purse. It was pretty long, but I was sure there'd be additions by now. I called her on my cell phone, and she had already thought of three more items to add, so I was some little while in the store. My arms were weighed down with plastic bags as I struggled up the steps to the back porch. Amelia shot out to the car to grab the other bags.
"Where have you been?"
she asked, as if she'd been standing by the door tapping her toe. I looked at my watch. "I got out of church and went to the store," I said defensively. "It's only one." Amelia passed me again, heavily laden. She shook her head in exasperation as she went by, making a noise that could only be described as, "Argh!" The rest of the afternoon was like that, as though Amelia was getting ready for the date of her life. I'm not a bad cook, but Amelia would let me do only the most menial chores in fixing the dinner. I got to chop onions and tomatoes. Oh, yeah, she let me wash the preparation dishes. I'd always wondered if she could do the dishes like the fairy godmothers in Sleeping Beauty, but she just snorted when I brought it up. The house was spanky clean, and though I tried not to mind, I noticed that Amelia had even given the floor of my bedroom a once-over. As a rule, we didn't go into each other's space. "Sorry I went in your room," Amelia said suddenly, and I jumped, me, the telepath. Amelia had beaten me at my own game. "It was one of those crazy impulses I get. I was vacuuming, and I just thought I'd get your floor, too, and before I thought about it, I was done. I put your slippers up under your bed." "Okay," I said, trying to sound neutral. "Hey, I am sorry." I nodded and went back to drying the dishes and putting them away. The menu, as decided by Amelia, was tossed green salad with tomatoes and slivered carrots, lasagna, hot garlic bread, and steamed fresh mixed vegetables. I don't know diddly squat about steamed vegetables, but I had prepared all the raw materials, the zucchini, bell peppers, mushrooms, cauliflower. Late in the afternoon, I was deemed capable of tossing the salad, and I got to put the cloth and the little bouquet of flowers on the table and arrange the place settings. Four place settings. I'd offered to take Mr. Marley into the living room with me, where we could eat on TV trays, but you would have thought I'd offered to wash his feet, Amelia was so horrified.
"No, you're sticking with me," she said.
"You gotta talk to your dad," I said. "At some point, I'm leaving the room." She took a deep breath and let it out.
"Okay, I'm a grown-up," she muttered.
"Scaredy cat," I said. "You haven't met him yet." Amelia hurried upstairs at 4:15 to get ready. I was sitting in the living room reading a library book when I heard a car on the gravel driveway. I glanced at the clock on the mantel. It was 4:48. I yelled up the staircase and stood to look out the window. The afternoon was drawing to a close, but since we hadn't reverted to standard time yet, it was easy to see the Lincoln Town car parked in front. A man with clipped dark hair, wearing a business suit, got out of the driver's seat. This must be Marley. He wasn't wearing a chauffeur's hat, somewhat to my disappointment. He opened a rear door. Out stepped Copley Carmichael. Amelia's dad wasn't very tall, and he had short, thick gray hair that looked like a really good carpet, dense and smooth and expertly cut. He was very tan, and his eyebrows were still dark. No glasses, no lips. Well, he did have lips, but they were really thin, so his mouth looked like a trap. Mr. Carmichael looked around him as if he were doing a tax assessment. I heard Amelia clattering down the stairs behind me as I watched the man in my front yard complete his survey. Marley, the chauffeur, was looking right at the house. He'd spotted my face at the window.
Marley sort of knew, Amelia said. He's been with my dad for just 2 years.
Your dad's always had a driver?
Yeah. Marley's a bodyguard, too,
Amelia said casually, as if everyone's dad had a bodyguard.
They were walking up the gravel sidewalk now, not even looking at its neat border of ilex. Up the wooden steps, across the front porch, knocking.
I thought of all the scary creatures that had been in my house. Wares, shifters, vampires, even a demon or two. Why should I be worried about this man? I straightened my spine, chilled my anxious brain, and went to the front door, though Amelia almost beat me to it. After all, this was my house. I put my hand on the knob, and I got my smile ready before I opened the door.
Please come in, I said,
and Marley opened the screen door for Mr. Carmichael, who came in and hugged his daughter, but not before he'd cast another comprehensive look around the living room. He was as clear a broadcaster as his daughter. He was thinking this looked mighty shabby for a daughter of his. Pretty girl Amelia was living with, wondered if Amelia was having sex with her. The girl was probably no better than she should be. No police record, though she had dated a vampire and had a wild brother. Of course, a rich and powerful man like Copley Carmichael would have his daughter's new housemaid investigated. Such a procedure had simply never occurred to me, like so many things the rich did. I took a deep breath.
I'm Sookie Stackhouse, I said politely. You must be Mr. Carmichael, and this is?
After shaking Mr. Carmichael's hand, I extended mine to Marley. For a second, I thought I'd caught Amelia's dad off-footed, but he recovered in record time.
This is Tyrese Marley, Mr. Carmichael said smoothly.
The chauffeur shook my hand gently, as if he didn't want to break my bones, and then he nodded to Amelia.
Miss Amelia,
he said, and Amelia looked angry, as if she was going to tell him to cut the miss, but then she reconsidered. All these thoughts, pinging back and forth, it was enough to keep me distracted. Tyrese Marley was a very, very light-skinned African-American. He was far from black. His skin was more the color of old ivory. His eyes were bright hazel. Though his hair was black, it wasn't curly, and it had a red cast. Marley was a man you'd always look at twice.
I'll take the car back to town and get some gas, he said to his boss, while you spend time with Miss Amelia. When you want me back?
Mr. Carmichael looked down at his watch.
A couple of hours.
You're welcome to stay for supper, I said, managing a very neutral tone. I wanted what made everyone feel comfortable.
I have a few errands I need to run,
Tyrese Marley said with no inflection.
Thanks for the invitation. I'll see you later.
He left. Okay, end of my attempt at democracy. Tyrese couldn't have known how much I would have preferred going into town rather than staying in the house. I braced myself and began the social necessities.
Can I get you a glass of wine, Mr. Carmichael, or something else to drink? What about you, Amelia?
Call me Cope,
he said, smiling. It was way too much like a shark's grin to warm my heart.
Sure, a glass of whatever's open. You, baby?
Some of the white, she said, and I heard her telling her dad to be seated as I went to the kitchen. I served the wine and added it to the tray with our hors d'oeuvres, crackers, a warm brie spread, and apricot jam mixed with hot peppers. We had some cute little knives that looked good with the tray, and Amelia had gotten cocktail napkins for the drinks. Cope had a good appetite, and he enjoyed the brie. He sipped the wine, which was an Arkansas label, and nodded politely. Well, at least he didn't spit it out. I seldom drink, and I'm no kind of wine connoisseur. In fact, I'm not a connoisseur of anything at all, but I enjoyed the wine, sip by sip.
"Amelia, tell me what you're doing with your time while you're waiting for your home to be repaired,"
Cope said, which I thought was a reasonable opening. I started to tell him that, for starters, she wasn't screwing around with me, but I thought that might be a little too direct. I tried very hard not to read his thoughts, but I swear, with him and his daughter in the same room, it was like listening to a television broadcast. "I've done some filing for one of the local insurance agents, and I'm working part-time at Merlot's Bar," Amelia said. "I serve drinks and the occasional chicken basket."
"Is the bar work interesting?"
Cope didn't sound sarcastic, I'll give him that, but of course I was sure he'd had Sam researched, too. "It's not bad," she said with a slight smile. That was a lot of restraint for Amelia. So I checked into her brain to see that she was squeezing herself into a conversational girdle. "I get good tips." Her father nodded.
"You, Miss Stackhouse?"
Cope asked politely. He knew everything about me, but the shade of fingernail polish I was wearing, and I was sure he'd add that to my file if he could. "I work at Merlot's full-time," I said, just as if he didn't know that. "I've been there for years."
"You have family in the area?"
"Oh, yes, we've been here forever," I said, "or as close to forever as Americans get. But our family's dwindled down. It's just me and my brother now."
"Older brother, younger?"
"Older," I said. "Married, real recently."
"So maybe there'll be other little stack houses,"
he said, trying to sound like he thought that would be a good thing. I nodded as if the possibility pleased me, too. I didn't like my brother's wife much, and I thought it was entirely possible that any kids they had would be pretty rotten. In fact, one was on the way right now, if Crystal didn't miscarry again. My brother was a werepanther, bitten, not born, and his wife was a born, a pure werepanther, that is. Being raised in the little werepanther community of Hotshot was not an easy thing, and would be even harder for kids who weren't pure.
"Dad, can I get you some more wine?"
Amelia was out of her chair like a shot, and she sped on her way to the kitchen with the half-empty wine glass. Good, quality alone time with Amelia's dad.
"Sookie,"
Cope said,
"you've been very kind to let my daughter live with you all this time."
"Amelia pays rent," I said. "She buys half the groceries. She pays her way."
"Nonetheless, I wish you'd let me give you something for your trouble."
"What Amelia gives me on rent is enough. After all, she's paid for some improvements to the property, too." His face sharpened then, as if he was on the scent of something big. Did he think I'd talked Amelia into putting a pool in the backyard? "She got a window air conditioner put in her bedroom upstairs," I said. "And she got an extra phone line for the computer. And I think she got a throw rug and some curtains for her room, too."
"She lives upstairs?"
"Yes," I said, surprised he didn't somehow know already. Perhaps there were a few things his intelligence net hadn't scooped up. "I live down here, she lives up there, and we share the kitchen and living room, though I think Amelia's got a TV upstairs, too." "Hey, Amelia," I called.
"Yeah?"
Her voice floated down the hall from the kitchen. "You still got that little TV up there?"
"Yeah, I hooked it up to the cable."
"Just wondered." I smiled at Cope, indicating the conversational ball was in his court. He was thinking of several things to ask me, and he was thinking of the best way to approach me to get the most information. A name popped to the surface in the whirlpool of his thoughts, and it took everything I had to keep a polite expression.
"The first tenant Amelia had in the house, on Chloe, she was your cousin, right?"
Cope said. "Hadley, yes." I kept my face calm as I nodded.
"Did you know her?"
"I know her husband," he said, and smiled.
Chapter 3. I knew Amelia had returned and was standing by the wingback chair where her father sat, and I knew she was frozen in place. I knew I didn't breathe for a second. I never met him, I said. I felt as if I'd been walking in a jungle and fallen into a concealed pit. I was sure glad I was the only telepath in the house. I hadn't told anyone at all, about what I'd found in Hadley's lockbox when I'd cleaned it out that day at the bank in New Orleans. They'd been divorced for a while before Hadley died.
You should take the time to meet him someday. He's an interesting man,
Cope said, as if he wasn't aware he was dropping a bombshell on me. Of course, he was waiting for my reaction. He'd hoped I hadn't known about the marriage at all, that I'd be taken completely by surprise.
He's a skilled carpenter. I'd love to track him down and hire him again.
The chair he was sitting on had been upholstered in a cream-colored material with lots of tiny blue flowers on green arching stems embroidered on it. It was still pretty, if faded. I concentrated on the pattern of the chair so I wouldn't show Copley Carmichael how very angry I was.
He doesn't mean anything to me, no matter how interesting he is, I said in a voice so level you could have played pool on it.
Their marriage was over and done. As I'm sure you know, Hadley had another partner at the time she died. Was murdered, but the government hadn't gotten around to taking much notice of vampire deaths unless those deaths were caused by humans. Vampires did most of their own self-policing.
I'd think you'd want to see the baby, though,
Copley said. Thank God I picked this out of Copley's head a second or two before he actually spoke the words. Even knowing what he was going to say, I felt his oh-so-casual remark hit me like a blow to the stomach. But I didn't want to give him the satisfaction of letting him see that. My cousin Hadley was wild. She used drugs and people. She wasn't the most stable person in the world. She was really pretty, and she had a way about her, so she always had admirers. There, I'd said everything pro and con about my cousin Hadley, and I hadn't said the word baby.
What baby?
How'd your family feel when she became a vampire?
Cope said. Hadley's change was a matter of public record. Turned vampires were supposed to register when they entered their altered state of being. They had to name their maker. It was a kind of governmental vampire birth control. You can bet the Bureau of Vampire Affairs would come down like a ton of bricks on a vampire who made too many other little vampires. Hadley had been turned by Sophie Ann LeClaire herself. Amelia had put her father's wine glass down within his reach and resumed her seat on the sofa beside me. Dad, Hadley lived upstairs from me for 2 years, she said. Of course we knew she was a vampire. For goodness sake, I thought you'd want to tell me all the hometown news. God bless Amelia. I was having a hard time holding myself together, and only years of doing that very thing when I telepathically overheard something awful was keeping me glued.
I need to check on the food. Excuse me, I murmured, and rose and left the room. I hoped I didn't scurry. I tried to walk normally, but once in the kitchen, I kept on going out the back door and across the back porch, out the screen door and into the yard. If I thought I'd hear Hadley's ghostly voice telling me what to do, I was disappointed. Vampires don't leave ghosts, at least as far as I know. Some vampires believe they don't possess souls. I don't know. That's up to God. And here I was babbling to myself because I didn't want to think about Hadley's baby, about the fact that I hadn't known about the child. Maybe it was just Copley's way. Maybe he always wanted to demonstrate the extent of his knowledge as a way of showing his power to the people he dealt with. I had to go back in there for Amelia's sake. I braced myself, put my smile back on, though I knew it was a creepy, nervous smile, and back I went. I perched by Amelia and beamed at both of them. They looked at me expectantly, and I realized a conversational lull had fallen.
Oh, said Cope suddenly. Amelia, I forgot to tell you. Someone called the house for you last week, someone I didn't know.
Her name?
Oh, let me think. Mrs. Beach wrote it down.
Ophelia? Octavia? Octavia Fant. That was it. Unusual.
I thought Amelia was going to faint. She turned a funny color, and she braced her hand against the arm of the couch.
You're sure? She asked.
Yes, I'm sure. I gave her your cell phone number, and I told her you were living in Bon Ton.
Thanks, Dad, Amelia croaked. I'll bet supper's done. Let me go check.
Didn't Sookie just look at the food?
He wore the broad, tolerant smile a man wears when he thinks women are being silly.
Oh, sure, but it's in the end stage, I said while Amelia shot out of the room as swiftly as I'd just done. It would be awful if it burned. Amelia worked so hard.
Do you know this Ms. Fant?
Cope asked.
No, I can't say as I do.
Amelia looked almost scared.
No one's trying to hurt my girl, right?
He was a different man when he said that, and one I could almost like.
No matter what else he was, Cope didn't want anyone hurting his daughter. Anyone except him, that is.
I don't think so.
I knew who Octavia Fant was because Amelia's brain had just told me, but she herself hadn't spoken it out loud, so it wasn't a thing I could share. Sometimes the things I hear out loud and the things I hear in my head become really tangled and confused, one of the reasons why I have a reputation for being borderline crazy.
You're a contractor, Mr. Carmichael?
Cope, please. Yes, among other things.
I guess your business must be booming right now, I said.
If my company was twice as big, we couldn't keep up with the jobs there are to do, he said. But I hated to see New Orleans all torn up.
Oddly enough, I believed him.
Supper went smoothly enough. If Amelia's father was disconcerted at eating in the kitchen, he didn't give a sign of it. Since he was a builder, he noticed that the kitchen portion of the house was new, and I had to tell him about the fire, but that could have happened to anyone, right? I left out the part about the arsonist. Cope seemed to enjoy his food and complimented Amelia, who was mighty pleased. He had another glass of wine with his meal, but no more than that, and he ate moderately, too. He and Amelia talked about friends of the family and some relatives, and I was left alone to think. Believe me, I had a lot of thinking to do. Hadley's marriage license and divorce decree had been in her lockbox at her bank when I'd opened it after her death. The box had contained some family things, a few pictures, her mother's obituary, several pieces of jewelry. There'd also been a lock of fine hair, dark and wispy, with a bit of scotch tape to keep it together. It had been placed in a little envelope. I'd wondered when I'd noticed how fine the hair was. But there hadn't been a birth certificate or any other scrap of evidence that Hadley had had a baby. Up until now, I'd had no clearly defined reason to contact Hadley's former husband. I hadn't even known he existed until I'd opened her lockbox. He wasn't mentioned in her will. I'd never met him. He hadn't shown up while I was in New Orleans. Why hadn't she mentioned the child in her will? Surely any parent would do that. And though she'd named Mr. Cataliades and me as the joint executors, she hadn't told either of us, well, she hadn't told me, that she had relinquished her rights to her child either.
Sookie, would you pass the butter?
Amelia asked, and I could tell from her tone it wasn't the first time she'd spoken to me.
Of course, I said. Can I get either of you any more water or another glass of wine?
They both declined.
After supper, I volunteered to do the dishes. Amelia accepted my offer after a brief pause. She and her father had to have some time alone, even if Amelia didn't relish the prospect. I washed and dried and put away the dishes in relative peace. I wiped down the counters and whipped the tablecloth off the table and popped it into the washer on the enclosed back porch. I went into my room and read for a while, though I didn't take in much of what was happening on the page. Finally, I laid the book aside and got a box out of my underwear drawer. This box contained everything I'd retrieved from Hadley's lockbox.
I checked the name on the marriage certificate. On impulse, I called information.
I need a listing for a Remy Savoy, I said.
What city?
New Orleans.
That number's been disconnected.
Try Metairie.
No, ma'am.
Okay, thanks.
Of course, a lot of people had moved since Katrina, and a lot of those moves were permanent. People who had fled the hurricane had no reason to come back in many cases. There was nowhere to live and no job to go to in all too many cases. I wondered how to search for Hadley's ex-husband. A very unwelcome solution crept into my head. Bill Compton was a computer whiz. Maybe he could track down this Remy Savoy, find out where he was now, discover if the child was with him. I rolled the idea around in my head like a mouthful of doubtful wine. Given our exchange of the night before at the wedding, I could not imagine myself approaching Bill to ask for a favor, though he'd be the right man for the job. A wave of longing for Quinn almost took me to my knees. Quinn was a smart and well-traveled man, and he would surely have a good piece of advice for me, if I ever saw him again. I shook myself. I could just hear a car pulling into the parking area by the sidewalk at the front of the house. Tyrese Marley was returning for Cope. I straightened my back and left my room, my smile fixed firmly on my face. The front door was open, and Tyrese was standing in it, pretty much filling it up from side to side. He was a big man. Cope was leaning over to give his daughter a peck on the cheek, which she accepted without a hint of a smile. Bob the cat came through the door and sat down beside her. The cat was looking up at Amelia's father with his wide-eyed stare.
"You have a cat, Amelia? I thought you hated cats."
Bob switched his gaze to Amelia. Nothing can stare like a cat.
"Dad, that was years ago. This is Bob. He's great."
Amelia picked up the black and white cat and held him to her chest. Bob looked smug and began purring.
Well, I'll be calling you. Please take care. I hate to think about you being up here at the other end of the state.
It's just a few hours ride away, Amelia said, sounding all of 17.
True, he said, trying for rueful but charming. He missed by a foot or two. Sookie, thanks for the evening, he called over his daughter's shoulder.
Marley had gone to Merlot's to see if he could scope out any information on me, I heard clearly from his brain. He picked up quite a few odds and ends. He talked to Arlene, which was bad, and to our current cook and our busboy, which was good, plus assorted bar patrons. He'd have a mixed report to convey. The moment the car pulled away, Amelia collapsed onto the sofa with relief.
"Thank God he's gone," she said.
"Now do you see what I mean?"
"Yeah," I said.
I sat beside her. "He's a mover and a shaker, isn't he?"
"Always has been," she said. "He's trying to maintain a relationship, but our ideas don't match."
"Your dad loves you."
"He does, but he loves power and control, too."
That was putting it conservatively.
"And he doesn't know you have your own form of power."
"No, he doesn't believe in it at all," Amelia said. "He'll tell you he's a devout Catholic, but that's not the truth."
"In a way, that's good," I said. "If he believed in your witch power, he'd try to make you do all kinds of things for him. You wouldn't want to do some of them, I bet."
I could have bitten my tongue, but Amelia didn't take offense.
"You're right," she said. "I wouldn't want to help him advance his agenda. He's capable of doing that without my assistance. If he'd just leave me alone, I'd be content. He's always trying to improve my life on his terms. I'm really doing okay."
"Who was that who had you called in New Orleans?" Though I knew I had to pretend.
"Fant, her name was?"
Amelia shuddered.
"Octavia Fant is my mentor," she said. "She's the reason I left New Orleans. I figured my coven would do something awful to me when they found out about Bob. She's the head of my coven, or what's left of it, if anything's left of it."
"Oops."
"Yeah, no shit.
I'm going to have to pay the price now.
You think she'll come up here?
I'm only surprised she's not here already.
Despite her expressed fear, Amelia had been worried sick about the welfare of her mentor after Katrina. She had made a huge effort to track the woman, though she didn't want Octavia to find her. Amelia feared being discovered, especially with Bob still in his cat form. She told me that her dabbling in transformational magic would be considered all the more reprehensible because she was still an intern, or something along those lines, a step above novice anyway. Amelia didn't discuss the witch infrastructure.
You didn't think of telling your father not to reveal your location?
Asking him to do that would have made him so curious he'd have torn up my entire life to find out why I'd asked. I never thought Octavia would call him, since she knows how I feel about him. Which was, to say the least, conflicted.
I have something to tell you that I forgot, Amelia said abruptly. Speaking of phone calls, Eric called you.
When?
Last night, before you got home. You were so full of news when you got here, I just forgot to tell you. Plus, you'd said you were going to call him anyway, and I was really upset about my dad coming. I'm sorry, Sookie. I promise I'll write a note next time.
This was not the first time Amelia had neglected to tell me about a caller. I wasn't pleased, but it was water under the bridge, and our day had been stressful enough. I hoped Eric had found out about the money the Queen owed me for my services in Rhodes. I hadn't gotten a check yet, and I hated to bug her since she'd been hurt so badly. I went to the phone in my room to call Fantasia, which should be in full blast. The club was open every night except Monday.
Fantasia, the bar with a bite, Clancy said.
Oh, great, my least favorite vampire.
I phrased my request carefully.
Clancy, it's Sookie. Eric asked me to return his call.
There was a moment of silence. I was willing to bet that Clancy was trying to figure out if he could block my access to Eric. He decided he couldn't.
One moment, he said.
A brief pause while I listened to Strangers in the Night. Then Eric picked up the phone.
Hello,
he said.
I'm sorry I didn't call you back before now. I just got your message. Did you call about my money?
A moment of silence.
No, about something else entirely. Will you go out with me tomorrow night?
I stared at the telephone. I couldn't manage a coherent thought. Finally, I said,
Eric, I'm dating Quinn.
And how long has it been since you've seen him?
Since Rhodes?
How long has it been since you heard from him?
Since Rhodes?
My voice was wooden. I was unwilling to talk to Eric about this, but we had shared blood often enough to have a much stronger tie than I liked. In fact, I loathed our bond, one we'd been compelled to forge. But when I heard his voice, I felt content. When I was with him, I felt beautiful and happy, and there was nothing I could do about it.
I think you can give me one evening, Eric said. It doesn't sound as though Quinn has you booked.
That was mean.
It's Quinn who's cruel, promising you he'd be here and then not keeping his word.
There was a dark element in Eric's voice, an undertone of anger.
Do you know what's happened to him?
I asked.
Do you know where he is?
There was a significant silence.
No,
Eric said very gently.
I don't know. But there is someone in town who wants to meet you. I promised I would arrange it. I'd like to take you to Shreveport myself.
So this wasn't a date.
You mean that guy Jonathan? He came to the wedding and introduced himself. I've got to say, I didn't much care for the guy. No offense if he's a friend of yours.
Jonathan? What Jonathan?
I'm talking about the Asian guy. He's maybe Ty. He was at the Bellefleur wedding last night. He said he wanted to see me because he was staying in Shreveport, and he'd heard a lot about me. He said he checked in with you, like a good little visiting vampire.
I don't know him,
Eric said. His voice was much sharper.
I'll ask here at Fantasia to see if anyone has seen him, and I'll prompt the Queen about your money, though she is not herself. Now, will you please do what I'm asking you to do?
I made a face at the telephone. I guess, I said. Who am I meeting, and where?
I'll have to let the who remain a mystery,
Eric said.
As to where, we'll go to dinner at a nice restaurant, the kind you'd call casual dressy.
You don't eat. What will you do?
I'll introduce you and stay as long as you need me to.
A crowded restaurant should be all right. Okay, I said, not very graciously. I'll get off work about 6 or 6:30.
I'll be there to pick you up at 7.
Give me till 7:30. I need to change. I knew I sounded grumpy, and that was exactly how I felt. I hated the big mystery around this meeting.
You'll feel better when you see me,
he said. Damn it. He was absolutely right. Chapter 4. I checked my word of the day calendar while I was waiting for my hair straightening iron to heat up. Epicene. Huh. Since I didn't know what restaurant we were going to, and I didn't know who we'd meet there, I picked my most comfortable option and wore a sky blue silk t-shirt that Amelia had said was too big for her, and some black dress slacks with black heels. I don't wear a lot of jewelry, so a gold chain and some little gold earrings did the decorating for me. I'd had a tough day at work, but I was too curious about the evening ahead to feel tired. Eric was on time, and I felt, surprise, a rush of pleasure when I saw him. I don't think that was entirely due to the blood bond between us. I think any heterosexual woman would feel a rush of pleasure at the sight of Eric. He was a tall man, and must have been seen as a giant in his time. He was built to swing a heavy sword to hew down his enemies. Eric's golden blonde hair sprang back like a lion's mane from a bold forehead. There was nothing epicene about Eric, nothing ethereally beautiful either. He was all male. Eric bent to kiss me on the cheek. I felt warm and safe. This was the effect Eric had on me, now that we'd swapped blood more than 3 times. The blood sharing hadn't been for pleasure, but a necessity. At least, I thought so, every time, but the price I paid was steep. We were bonded now, and when he was near, I was absurdly happy. I tried to enjoy the sensation, but knowing it wasn't completely natural made that hard to do. Since Eric had come in his Corvette, I was extra glad I'd worn pants. Getting into and out of a Corvette modestly was a very difficult procedure if you were wearing a dress. I made small talk on the way to Shreveport, but Eric was uncharacteristically silent. I tried to question him about Jonathan, the mysterious vampire at the wedding, but Eric said,
"We'll talk about that later. You haven't seen him again, have you?"
"No," I said. "Should I expect to?" Eric shook his head. There was an uncomfortable pause. From the way he was gripping the wheel, I could tell that Eric was building up to saying something he didn't want to say.
"I'm glad for your sake that it appears Andre didn't survive the bombing," he said.
The Queen's dearest child, Andre, had died in the bombing in Rhodes, but it hadn't been the bomb that had killed him. Quinn and I knew what had done the deed, a big splinter of wood that Quinn had driven into Andre's heart while the vampire lay disabled. Quinn had killed Andre for my sake, because he knew Andre had plans for me that made me sick with fear. "I'm sure the Queen will miss him," I said carefully. Eric shot me a sharp glance.
"The Queen is distraught," he said, "and her healing will take months more. What I was beginning to say..."
His voice trailed off. This wasn't like Eric.
"What?"
I demanded.
"You saved my life," he said.
I'd turned to look at him, but he was looking straight ahead at the road.
"You saved my life, and Pam's too."
I shifted uncomfortably.
"Yeah, well..."
Miss Articulate. The silence lengthened until I felt I had to say something else.
We do have the blood tie thing going.
Eric didn't respond for a stretch of time.
That's not why you came to wake me, first of all, the day the hotel blew up, he said. But we won't talk further about this now. You have a big evening ahead.
Yes, boss, I said snippily, but only to myself. We were in a part of Shreveport I didn't know too well. It was definitely out of the main shopping area, with which I was fairly familiar. We were in a neighborhood where the houses were large and the lawns were groomed. The businesses were small and pricey, what retailers called boutiques. We pulled into a group of such shops. It was arranged in an L, and the restaurant was at the rear of the L. It was called Les Deux Poissons. There were maybe 8 cars parked there, and each one of them represented my yearly income. I looked down at my clothes, feeling suddenly uneasy.
Don't worry, you're beautiful, Eric said quietly.
He leaned over to unbuckle my seatbelt, to my astonishment, and as he straightened, he kissed me again, this time on the mouth. His bright blue eyes blazed out of his white face. He looked as if a whole story was on the tip of his tongue.
But then he swallowed it back and unfolded himself from the car to walk around to my side to open the door for me. Maybe I wasn't the only one this blood bond worked on, huh? From his tension, I realized that some major event was coming at me fast, and I began to be afraid. Eric took my hand as we walked across to the restaurant, and he ran his thumb absently across my palm. I was surprised to find out there was a direct line from my palm to my hoochie. We stepped into the foyer, where there was a little fountain and a screen that blocked the view of the diners. The woman standing at the podium was beautiful and black, her hair shaved very close to her skull. She wore a draped dress of orange and brown and the highest heels I had ever seen. She might as well have been wearing toe shoes. I looked at her closely, and I sampled the signature of her brain, and I found she was human. She smiled brilliantly at Eric and had the sense to give me a share of that smile.
A party of 2? She said. We're meeting someone, Eric said.
Oh, the gentleman.
Yes.
Right this way, please.
Her smile replaced by a look almost of envy, she turned and walked gracefully into the depths of the restaurant. Eric gestured for me to follow her. The interior was fairly dark, and candles flickered on the tables, which were covered with snowy white cloths and elaborately folded napkins. My eyes were on the hostess's back, so when she came to a halt, I didn't immediately recognize that she'd stopped at the table where we were to sit. She stepped aside. Seated facing me was the lovely man who'd been at the wedding 2 nights before. The hostess spun on her high heel, touched the back of the chair to the man's right to indicate I should sit there, and told us our server would be with us. The man rose to pull out my chair and hold it for me. I glanced back at Eric. He gave me a reassuring nod. I slipped in front of the chair, and the man pushed it forward with perfect timing. Eric didn't sit. I wanted him to explain what was happening, but he didn't speak. He looked almost sad. The beautiful man was looking at me intently.
Child,
he said to get my attention. Then he pushed back his long, fine golden hair. None of the other diners were positioned to see what he was showing me. His ear was pointed. He was a fairy. I knew 2 other fairies, but they avoided vampires at all costs because the smell of a fairy was as intoxicating to a vampire as honey is to a bear. According to a vampire who was particularly gifted in the scent sense, I had a trace of fairy blood. Okay, I said, to let him know the ears had registered.
Sookie, this is Niall Brigant,
Eric said. He pronounced it Niall.
He's going to talk to you over supper. I'll be outside if you need me.
He inclined his head stiffly to the fairy, and then he was gone. I watched Eric walk away, and I was bowled over with a rush of anxiety. Then I felt a hand on top of my own. I turned to meet the eyes of the fairy.
"As he said, my name is Niall."
His voice was light, sexless, resonant. His eyes were green, the deepest green you can imagine. In the flickering candlelight, the color hardly mattered. It was the depth you noticed. His hand on mine was light as a feather, but very warm. "Who are you?" I asked, and I wasn't asking him to repeat his name.
"I'm your great-grandfather," Niall Brigant said.
"Oh, shit," I said, and covered my mouth with my hand. "Sorry, I shook my head. "Great-grandpa?" I said, trying out the concept. Niall Brigant winced delicately. On a real man, the gesture would have looked effeminate, but on Niall, it didn't. Lots of kids in our neck of the woods call their grandfathers Paw-Paw. I'd love to see his reaction to that. The idea helped me recover my scattered sense of self.
"Please explain," I said very politely.
The waiter came to inquire after our drink orders and recite the specials of the day. Niall ordered a bottle of wine and told him we would have the salmon. He didn't consult me. High-handed. The young man nodded vigorously.
"Great choice," he said.
He was aware, and though I would have expected him to be curious about Niall, who, after all, was a supernatural being not often encountered, I seemed to be of more interest. I attributed that to the waiter's youth and my boobs.
See, here's the weird thing about meeting my self-proclaimed relative. I never doubted his truthfulness. This was my true great-grandfather, and the knowledge just clicked into place as if it fit into a puzzle.
"I'll tell you all about it,"
Niall said. Very slowly, telegraphing his intention, he leaned over to kiss my cheek. His mouth and eyes crinkled as his facial muscles moved to frame the kiss. The fine cobweb of wrinkles did not in any way detract from his beauty. He was like very old silk or a crackled painting by an ancient master. This was a big night for getting kissed.
"When I was still young, perhaps 500 or 600 years ago, I used to wander among the humans,"
Niall said.
"And every now and then, as a male will, I'd see a human woman I found appealing."
I glanced around so I wouldn't be staring at him every second, and I noticed a strange thing. No one was looking at us but our waiter. I mean, not even a casual glance strayed our way, and no human brains in the room were even registering our presence. My great-grandfather paused while I did this, and resumed speaking when I'd finished evaluating the situation.
"I saw such a woman in the woods one day, and her name was Einin. She thought I was an angel."
He was silent for a moment.
"She was delicious,"
he said.
"She was lively and happy and simple."
Niall's eyes were fixed on my face. I wondered if he thought I was like Einin, simple.
"I was young enough to be infatuated, young enough to be able to ignore the inevitable end of our connection as she aged and I did not. But Einin got pregnant, which was a shock. Fairies and humans don't cross-breed often. Einin gave birth to twins, which is quite common among the Fae. Einin and both boys lived through the birthing, which in those times was far from certain. She called our older son Fintan. The second was Dermot."
The waiter brought our wine, and I was jerked out of the spell Niall's voice had laid on me. It was like we'd been sitting around a campfire in the woods, listening to an ancient legend, and then, snap, We were in a modern restaurant in Shreveport, Louisiana, and there were other people around who had no idea what was going on. I automatically lifted my glass and took a sip of wine. I felt I was entitled.
Fintan the Half-Fairy was your paternal grandfather, Sookie?
Niall said.
No, I know who my grandfather was.
My voice was shaking a little, I noticed, but it was still very quiet.
My grandfather was Mitchell Stackhouse, and he married Adele Hale. My father was Corbett Hale Stackhouse, and he and my mom died in a flash flood when I was a little girl. Then I was raised by my grandmother, Adele.
Though I remembered the vampire in Mississippi who told me he detected a trace of fairy blood in my veins, and I believed this was my great-grandfather, I just couldn't adjust my inner picture of my family.
What was your grandmother like?
Niall asked.
She raised me when she didn't have to, I said. She took me and Jason into her home, and she worked hard to raise us right. We learned everything from her. She loved us. She had two children herself and buried them both, and that must have about killed her, but still she was strong for us.
She was beautiful when she was young,
Niall said. His green eyes lingered on my face as if he were trying to find some trace of her beauty in her granddaughter.
I guess, I said uncertainly. You don't think about your grandmother in terms of beauty, at least in the normal way of things.
I saw her after Fintan made her pregnant,
Niall said.
She was lovely. Her husband had told her he could not give her children. He'd had mumps at the wrong time. That's a disease, isn't it?
I nodded.
She met Fintan one day when she was beating a rug out on the clothesline in back of the house where you now live. He asked her for a drink of water. He was smitten on the spot. She wanted children so badly, and he promised her he could give them to her.
You said fairies and people weren't usually fertile when they crossbreed.
But Fintan was only half fairy, and he already knew that he was able to give a woman a child.
Niall's mouth quirked.
The first woman he loved died in childbirth, but your grandmother and her son were more fortunate. And then, 2 years later, she was able to carry Fintan's daughter to completion.
He raped her, I said, almost hoping it was so. My grandmother had been the most true blue woman I'd ever met. I couldn't picture her cheating anyone out of anything, particularly since she'd promised in front of God to be faithful to my grandfather.
No, he did not. She wanted children, though she didn't want to be unfaithful to her husband. Fintan didn't care about the feelings of others, and he wanted her desperately,
Niall said.
But he was never violent. He would not have raped her. However, my son could talk a woman into anything, even into something against her moral judgment. And if she was very beautiful, so was he.
I tried to see the woman she must have been in the grandmother I'd known, and I just couldn't.
What was your father like, my grandson?
Niall asked.
He was a handsome guy, I said. He was a hard worker. He was a good dad.
Niall smiled slightly.
How did your mother feel about him?
That question cut sharply into my warm memories of my father.
She was really devoted to him, maybe at the expense of her children.
She was obsessed.
Niall's voice was not judgmental, but certain, as if he knew my answer.
Real possessive, I admitted. Though I was only 7 when they died, even I could see that. I guess I thought it was normal.
She really wanted to give him all her attention. Sometimes Jason and I were in the way. And she was really jealous, I remember.
I tried to look amused, as if my mother being so jealous of my father was a charming quirk.
It was the fairy in him that made her hold on so strongly,
Niall said.
It takes some humans that way. She saw the supernatural in him, and it enthralled her. Tell me, was she a good mother?
She tried hard, I whispered. She had tried. My mother had known how to be a good mother theoretically. She knew how a good mother acted toward her children. She'd made herself go through all the motions. But all her true love had been saved for my father, who'd been bemused by the intensity of her passion. I could see that now, as an adult. As a child, I'd been confused and hurt.
The red-haired ware brought our salad and set it down in front of us. He wanted to ask us if we needed anything else, but he was too scared. He'd picked up on the atmosphere at the table.
"Why did you decide now to come meet me?" I asked. "How long have you known about me?"
I put my napkin in my lap and sat there holding the fork.
I should take a bite. Wasting was not part of the way I'd been raised. By my grandmother, who'd had sex with a half-fairy who'd wandered into the yard like a stray dog. Enough sex over enough time to produce two children.
I've known about your family for the past 60 years, give or take. But my son Fintan forbade me seeing any of you.
He carefully put a bit of tomato into his mouth, held it there, thought about it, chewed it. He ate the way I would if I was visiting an Indian or Nicaraguan restaurant.
What changed? I said, but I figured it out.
So your son is dead now?
Yes,
he said, and put down the fork.
Fintan is dead. After all, he was half-human, and he'd lived for 700 years.
Was I supposed to have an opinion about this? I felt so numb, as though Niall had shot Novocaine into my emotional center. I probably should ask how my grandfather had come to die, but I couldn't bring myself to do it.
So, you decided to come tell me about this. Why?
I was proud of how calm I sounded.
I'm old, even for my kind. I would like to know you. I can't atone for the way your life has been shaped by the heritage Fintan gave you, but I will try to make your life a little easier, if you permit me.
Can you take the telepathy away? I asked. A wild hope, not unmixed with fear, flared in me like a sunspot.
You are asking if I can remove something from the fiber of your being,
Niall said.
No, I can't do that.
I slumped in my chair. Thought I'd ask, I said, fighting away tears.
Do I get 3 wishes, or is that with genies?
Niall regarded me with no humor at all.
You wouldn't want to meet a genie, he said. And I'm not a figure of fun. I am a prince.
Sorry, I said. I'm having a little trouble coping with all this, great-grandfather. I didn't remember my human great-grandfathers. My grandfathers, okay, I guess one of them hadn't truly been my grandfather, hadn't looked or acted a thing like this beautiful creature. My grandfather Stackhouse died 16 years ago, and my mother's parents had died before I was into my teens. So I'd known my grandmother Adele much better than any of the others. Actually, much better than I'd known my true parents.
Hey, I said, how come Eric fetched me for you? You're a fairy, after all. Vampires go nuts when they smell fairies.
In fact, most vampires lost their self-control when they were around fairies.
Only a very disciplined vampire could behave when a fairy got within smelling distance. My fairy godmother, Claudine, was terrified of being anywhere around a bloodsucker.
I can suppress my essence,
Niall said.
They can see me, but not smell me. It's a convenient magic. I can keep humans from even noticing me, as you have observed.
The way he said this let me know that he was not only very old and very powerful, but he was also very proud. Did you send Claudine to me? I said.
Yes, I hope she's been of use. Only people of part fey blood can have such a relationship with a fairy. I knew you needed her.
Oh, yes, she saved my life, I said. She's been wonderful. She'd even taken me shopping. Are all fairies as nice as Claudine, or as beautiful as her brother? Claude, male stripper and now entrepreneur, was as handsome as a man could get, and he had the personality of a self-absorbed turnip.
Dear one,
Niall said,
we are all beautiful to humans, but some fairies are very nasty indeed.
Okay, here came the downside. I had a strong feeling that finding out I had a great-grandfather who was a full-blooded fairy was supposed to be good news, from Niall's point of view, but that it wasn't a completely iced cupcake. Now I would get the bad news.
You went many years without being found,
Niall said,
in part because that was what Fintan wanted.
But he watched me? I almost felt warmth in my heart at hearing that.
My son was remorseful that he'd condemned two children to the half-in, half-out existence he'd experienced as a fairy who wasn't truly a fairy. I'm afraid the others of our race weren't kind to him.
My great-grandfather's gaze was steady.
I did my best to defend him, but it wasn't enough. Fintan also found he wasn't human enough to pass as human, at least not for more than a short time.
You don't look like this normally? I asked, very curious.
No.
And just for a split second, I saw an almost blinding light with Niall in the middle of it, beautiful and perfect. No wonder Einan had thought he was an angel. Claudine said she was working her way up, I said. What does that mean? I was floundering through this conversation. I felt like I'd been knocked down to my knees by all this information, and I was struggling to get to my emotional feet. I wasn't having a very successful time doing it.
She shouldn't have told you that,
Niall said. He debated with himself for a second or two before continuing.
Shifters are humans with a genetic twist. Vampires are dead humans transformed into something different. But the Fae have only a basic shape in common with humans. There are many kinds of Fae, from the grotesque, like goblins, to the beautiful, like us.
He said this quite unselfconsciously. Are there angels?
Angels are yet another form, and one which has undergone an almost complete transformation, physical and moral. It can take hundreds of years to become an angel.
Poor Claudine.
But enough about this,
Niall said.
I want to know about you. My son kept me from your father and your aunt, and then from their children. His death came too late for me to know your cousin Hadley, but now I can see you and touch you.
Which, incidentally, Niall was doing in a way that wasn't exactly human. If his hand wasn't holding mine, it was placed flat against my shoulder or my back. This wasn't exactly the way humans related, but it wasn't hurting me. I wasn't as freaked out as I might have been, since I'd noticed Claudine was very touchy-feely, too. Since I couldn't get telepathic vibes from fairies, this much contact was tolerable. With a regular human being, I'd be bombarded with thoughts, since touch increased my sensitivity to telepathic contact. "Did Fenton have any other children or grandchildren?" I asked. It would be nice to have more family.
"We'll talk of that later,"
Niall said, which sent up an immediate red flag.
"Now that you know me a little," he said, "please tell me what I can do for you."
"Why should you do anything for me?" I said. We'd had the genie conversation. I wasn't going to revisit that.
"I can tell that your life has been hard. Now that I am allowed to see you, let me help you in some way."
"You sent me Claudine. She's been a big help," I repeated. Without the crutch of my sixth sense, I was having trouble understanding my great-grandfather's emotional and mental set. Was he grieving for a son? What had their relationship really been? Had Fenton thought he was doing us all a good deed in keeping his dad away from the Stackhouses all these years? Was Niall evil, or did he have bad intentions toward me? He could have done something awful to me from afar without going to the trouble of meeting me and paying for an expensive dinner.
"You wouldn't want to explain any more, huh?"
Niall shook his head, his hair brushing his shoulders like strands of gold and silver spun out to incredible fineness. I had an idea. "Can you find my boyfriend?" I asked hopefully.
"You have a man? Besides the vampire?"
"Eric is not my man, but since I've had his blood a few times and he's had mine..."
"That's why I approached you through him. You have a tie to him."
"Yes."
"I have known Eric Northman for a long time. I thought you would come if he asked you to. Did I do wrong?"
I was startled at this appeal. "No, sir," I said. "I don't think I'd have come if he hadn't told me it was okay. He wouldn't have brought me if he hadn't trusted you. At least, I don't think so."
"Do you want me to kill him and the tie?"
"No," I said, getting kind of excited in a bad way. "No!" A few people actually glanced at us for the first time, hearing my agitation, despite my great-grandfather's "don't look" influence.
"The other boyfriend,"
Niall said, and took another bite of his salmon.
"Who is he, and when did he vanish?"
"Quinn the Were-Tiger," I said. "He's been gone since the explosion in Rhodes. He was hurt, but I saw him afterward."
"I heard about the pyramid,"
Niall said.
"You were there?"
I told him about it, and my newly discovered great-grandfather listened with a refreshing lack of judgment. He was neither horrified nor appalled, and he didn't feel sorry for me. I really liked that. While I talked, I had a chance to regroup my emotions. "You know what?" I said when there was a natural pause. "Don't look for Quinn. He knows where I am, and he's got my number." In more ways than one, I thought sourly. "He'll show up when he feels like he can, I guess. Or not."
"But that leaves me with nothing to do as a gift for you,"
my great-grandfather said. "Just give me a rain check," I said, smiling, and then had to explain the term to him. "Something'll come up. Can I talk about you to my friends?" I asked. "No, I guess not." I couldn't imagine telling my friend Tara that I had a new great-grandfather who was a fairy. Amelia might be more understanding.
"I want to keep our relationship a secret,"
he said.
"I am so glad to know you finally, and I want to know you better."
He laid his hand against my cheek.
"But I have powerful enemies, and I wouldn't want them to think of harming you to get at me."
I nodded. I understood. But it was kind of deflating to have a brand new relative and be forbidden to talk about him. Niall's hand left my cheek to drift down to my own hand.
What about Jason? I asked. Are you going to talk to him, too?
Jason,
he said, his face showing distaste.
Somehow the essential spark passed Jason by. I know he is made of the same material as you, but in him the blood has only shown itself in his ability to attract lovers, which, after all, is not much recommendation. He wouldn't understand or appreciate